Welcome to the Amp Hour. I'm Dave Jones from the EEV blog.
I'm Fran Blanche from Fran Lab.
Hey, Fran, thanks for joining us again.
Hey, Dave.
Chris, our esteemed co-host, Chris Gamble, couldn't make it, so Fran stepped in at the last minute. Thank you very much.
Sure.
T-shirt's good. Love the. We are shooting video, by the way, if you want to watch this in video. Yeah. We are over on the we'll post the video on the Amp Hour as well. Yep.
Video and audio. Yeah, is this number three for me on the Amp Hour?
At least three.
Three.
At least. Yep. Could be three or four. Not sure.
Well, is it the third guest host time? Or because one time I was on with you and Chris.
Yes.
And I guest hosted.
And then there was another where it was just two of us.
Right. That was the first time. Right.
Right.
I was like that. I was the first guest host, first non-Chris Gamble on the Amp Hour way, 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 way back.
Yes. Wow. That was a long time ago in the galaxy
very
far,
time.
Far away. Yeah. And how many lab moves have you had since then?
Two.
Two. Same as me, I think. I think I've had, at least two. So, yeah.
Well, technically, so, you moved back. Didn't you actually move back, though?
I moved back into my old one, which kind of doesn't count, does it?
So it was like a, yeah, that's like
still a move.
It's like a. Yeah, that's true. Unfortunately, I just finished the taxes. I know you had your tax.
Oh, thing. I just did taxes. Oh God. Yeah.
Well, in after 2018, they no longer allowed moving expenses as a tax deduction. So
what?
Yeah.
Seriously?
So so these last two moves have been a complete loss.
That is nuts. How can that not be a regular business expense?
It's well. Ask
are you a sole trader or a LLC?
I'm a sole proprietorship.
Oh, okay, right. Surely, if you were an LLC, that would really it doesn't matter.
Yeah, it doesn't matter. Yeah. So it's the 1-2 punch because landlords can evict you because they're changing their property, and they can push you right out, and then you can't deduct the loss of being pushed out and having to move to another property. You have to just absorb that on top of everything else. So,
wow, that's incredible. Practically everything I do is a tax deduction.
Yeah.
I can just go somewhere and send one tweet and and the entire trip's a tax deduction.
Well, yeah, it's very similar with me. It's, every piece of equipment I buy is part of Fran Lab. It ends up, I got a new accountant this year because my last year's accountant moved out of town. So it was quite a learning curve. He was like, when I presented him with all the things, he was like, what do you do at Patreon? I said, well, I don't work at Patreon. I said, well, what did you do for this money? I said, well, I didn't do anything at Patreon. He says, they just give you this money. We don't do anything
give it
for
to you.
It.
Yeah.
And I said, well, actually, yeah. and he was looking at me like really angrily, and he says, when I showed him all the purchases that I had done last year, it was like almost six figures of like payouts and expenditures. He was like, well, what is this, all this stuff? And I said, it's everything, parts and equipment and, everything from solder to breadboards to clocks to things. He says, what are you doing with all this stuff? I said, well, I just... it took like half an hour to explain what it was that I do.
Yeah.
He says, okay, well, what do you do for a living? I said, well, I don't know. I said, my official profession now is I am paid to be Fran.
I love it. Paid to be Fran.
Yeah.
Wow. Yeah, because the majority of your income is it Patreon or is it YouTube or is it
Patreon?
Split?
It's split, but Patreon is definitely number one.
Right. Yep. Wow. And that's technically like they're just giving you money. Like you don't, although you do ship stuff in return, like occasionally you might send someone a patch or something, but it's not really. It's like
it's not really quid pro quo. It's yeah.
No, it's yeah. They're just giving you money because they like your stuff.
Yeah. It's
for being Fran, as you say.
it's very hard to explain.
Oh, that's crazy. Yeah, I changed accountants because my old accountant he retired. But it was like, so I was dreading that. I was dreading going to the new accountant, but it was seamless. And he was better. So he was like, he actually understood it. And I pretty much operate just like a standard business. Like to them, I'm just a, you know, a packing and shipping business kind of thing. So, and all the income's just income. It doesn't matter what I actually do. Yeah. It's all just, you know, classed as business income and expenses.
It used to be like that for me when I was in manufacturing. It was very straightforward. Most accountants can understand the nuts and bolts of a manufacturing operation. Yep. It's harder to explain this.
Right. I don't understand why you have to explain it, though. It just seems like it shouldn't, like, income's income and expenses are expenses. Why does it matter? That's just nuts.
I think you have to have, we have to state a job title,
right?
What you do. Yep. I think when I craned my neck around the monitor, I think he typed in spokesperson as my profession.
Spokesperson. Yeah, we have those here. We have the official tax. You have to fit into one of their categories. And yeah. I don't know what I am. I'm just like, you know, Joe Blogs engineer or something probably. No, I'm a videographer. I'm a videographer, I think, is my official tax thing. So, yeah.
And I don't know if they still have that as a category, but they used to have videography was a thing in the 80s. I don't know if it's a thing now.
There is YouTuber, I think.
YouTuber is an actual...
I think it's an actual category, but I don't know. I just haven't updated. But I think it's been added because there's so many people doing it now, so... You know,
so I used to file as a videographer back in the late 80s, early 90s when I was a videographer.
A real videographer. Yep.
Yeah, I used to. I had a Panasonic linear editing suite, the AG series.
Sweet.
Super VHS, you know, dual Super VHS deck with the AG controller. It was state of the art at the time.
Wow.
Cost a fortune. Had to take out a loan to buy the system and everything. Took years to pay it off. But I edited in Super VHS for a good decade, you know, from like Incredible. 90 to I was still doing Super VHS into the aughts.
Wow. Have you still got that kit?
No, the system. I don't have the system. I still have one of the cameras and a few playback decks, but no, I don't have that original system.
Because that'd be great to see if it still works and see if you can feed video into it and see what you can get out of it. Like modern standards, it's like.
At this point, it wouldn't operate without, you know, they'd have to be overhauled at this point. But it was an amazing system because it had frame, you know, half frame, like per field accuracy for the cut in and out.
Yeah.
Yeah. And it was hi-fi audio, which was, you know, scanned right into the into the track. I used to do commercials and weddings and stuff like that, music videos for local bands. And
oh, wow.
Plus my own projects. I was doing film and video. So I had, you know, transferring film, transferring slides, corporate stuff.
Incredible.
It's not like I made any money doing it.
Right. But, well, you made something, obviously. So I tied you by. Was that like, and you were doing FranLab at the time? Were you doing, you were doing Frantone. Sorry.
Oh, this is before that.
Before Frantone. Yeah. Okay. When did Frantone start? When was the pedal business?
Mert and I started talking about it and working on a product in 94. And then we spent a year and about $30,000 building a prototype, which was the pedal that failed because it just turned out to be impossible to build. I mean, we could have built it, but it would have cost us more to build it than we could have sold it for. And then I revamped and retooled and used the off-the-shelf case knobs and such and went and built the Hepcat in 95, 96. But it took a good 18 months to get it rolling as a company. So,
wow. But yeah. Now, I'll have to link in down below. You did a recent video on why don't I just make a few pedals? And that was really terrific because I've never heard you talk about the whole physical production process before, like in terms of like everything's about the case. It's got nothing to do with making the PCB. That's like trivial, right? Yeah. Anyone can make your PCB, copy it, but it's the amount of effort that goes into the physical case,
right?
And the multi-layer lacquering process and the silk screen and the spray painting, how you had to design a custom booth. And I found that fascinating.
Well, yeah,
that was just remarkable.
Well, it's funny because there were so many comments to the effect of, oh, it seems like you were in the painting business, not in the pedal business. And,
right.
And, you know, why would you care about that? No one cares about what the case looks like and stuff. Well, I beg to differ, first of all. it was very unusual to have a pedal that would be made to be looked at up close. You know, that's the thing.
Why is that? Why was it made to look up close?
Well, because don't
these things normally sit on the stage floor or something, and you operate them with your foot or something?
Yes, but you see, I knew that when this we're talking the 90s, so
yeah,
I knew that a person. This is before the internet was a thing for buying pedals. If you're buying a new pedal, you went into a guitar store,
yeah,
and they had glass cases with pedals and everything.
Of course,
pointed
yes.
at it. That they were
you
laid
want the
out
sexiest
like
looking one, yeah,
like candy at a can, like an old candy counter at the movie theater where all the candy would be laid out under the glass. That's how the pedals were displayed, and so you needed to be seen in like a sea of things. Mm. And when they pulled it out and handed it to you, they would, you know, they'd look at the pedal like this, you know, they'd twiddle the knobs and
right.
everything. The first impression was close up. So if you had complete shit coating on it and crappy silkscreen, first thing you're gonna see is this thing is a piece of shit.
yeah it's cheap, it's made in China,
exactly.
Or it's, you know, it's just yeah.
So,
wow. I didn't think about that. Of course, that is obvious,
yeah,
that's the case. And so that's why you need a light, like a nice bold color, like you need a big pink to sort of like stand out from the crowd, or you need, you know, lime green or something to
Well, my colors were always inspired by food.
Food, okay.
Yeah. So lots of pastels. But yeah, the color combinations, and also the knobs that I could get. In the early days, Davies was the only company to make that 1400 series chicken head knob that I used. And so... this is before they were making them in China. So in order to get like knobs that weren't just black, I had to go Davies Molding, and they were making the knobs out of Bakelite, which is a thermoset process. It's a phenolic, you know, thermoset plastic. So difficult to do, and the molds were very old. So often when they would put the two molds together, they wouldn't they wouldn't interface completely. So I would have to order like 1,000 knobs. And I might be ordering, if I was ordering like white knobs and they made 1,000 of them, I would have to go through every single knob and check it.
No.
And usually some of them were just so poorly molded that they'd have lots of flash, you know, like the... it would be like this rickety kind of like muffin top, you know, on the bottom, like it would just, you know, like where the nose wasn't molded all the way, or they'd be filled with inclusions. I'd order white knobs, but they're filled with flecks of black and blue and red because they didn't clean out the machine completely.
Oh, from the previous run or whatever.
Right. So it would be like cookies and cream. And so all the knobs that weren't like white. And so I would have to go through all 1,000 knobs. I'd probably reject like 40-50% of them.
Wow.
And I'd That's have to incredible. Send those back to Davies.
Yeah.
But it was like that every time, you know. And
wow.
They didn't have inserts on the knobs for the set screws. So they've
Going to ask, which ones do you use, the set screw onto a fluted shaft onto a flat shaft, or were you a fluted? Did you use like the spline shaft or whatever it's called?
They didn't offer that. Davies, it was a solid Bakelite knob, and they just tapped the phenolic plastic to put the brass screw in. So, you know, maybe 5% of the knobs were stripped out. So you'd have to check that, you know, and those would go in the reject booth.
That would be the quality of your product, would be like how the knob stays on, right? If this thing's used on stage and, you know, and the knobs are just flying off everywhere, you know, it's being tossed around and abused. I would have thought you'd go for more than, I don't know, some better than some sort of like just embedded set screw.
It wasn't an option. If you wanted that knob, it had to come from Davies because it was a 1400 series. It had to come from Davies, and they only made it one way.
Right.
But they learned to hate my name. Because every time I ordered knobs, every time I ordered knobs, they're again. I'm going to send half of them back.
Oh no! Unbelievable. Yeah. So, no, did you ever like hold them on with glue? Did you ever Loctite them on or anything? No.
You don't. That's
why
that's
not. You would think that'd be more robust.
No, that's quality with a K.
Right.
You know,
it's, okay.
You know, nothing half-assed. I didn't do anything half-assed. Okay.
Right.
That's sort of when you start having to do stuff like that, it's a death knell of a product when you're having to fudge it. I wanted the pedals to be the most robust. You said the way I designed them initially was for them to be like a tank. You know, that's why the battery compartment was an aluminum clip originally. The way that I mount the circuit board right on the switch and everything, I made it to be absolutely bulletproof because I knew what touring gear went through and what touring musicians would do to their equipment. Proof positive, I have some custom pedals, some one-offs that I built, like the Vigilantron that I built for Vigilante Carlstrom of the Hives. That pedal has been used. I built them three, but they're still using the first one. The original one is still in the rack and being played every time the Hives play and on every tour in every city for the last 12 years. So, and I caught up with them a few years ago and they said, I said, do you need any repairs or anything? They said, no, we're still using the original one. Still going.
Wow.
So
do on, audio, like, tour audio gear, do the connectors wear out and stuff like that? Because you're like going to like two or three, you know, a show every day and you've got to bang them in, bang them out. And
I used Switchcraft jacks, which are pretty robust. You pay a
fortune
for them.
You'll use 6.5 mil jacks, don't you?
Yeah, well, quarter inch.
Sorry. Metric.
Yeah, 6.5 mil. But yeah, it's quarter inch jacks. But the thing is with the quarter inch jacks, you... they were made for the telephone system originally.
Yes, to plug in now. Yeah, of course.
And they're by design, they're made to that size and stuff because you every time you insert the plug, you get a fresh surface or wipes the contact. So, Switchcraft jacks and everything. The most vulnerable part of the, as far as the hardware goes, is always turned out to be the DC jacks because there never was an option to get a heavy duty jack for that barrel plug.
Yeah, there's not, is there?
No.
Did you ever think about using something? No, but that's, you have to use that because that's the industry standard, right? And it's got to be center negative.
Right.
Right. Would be that center negative rubbish. Wow.
Right. Yeah. So yeah, the standard, the 5.5 mil standard, barrel jack, So again, you're at the mercy of what the parts manufacturers make, and they only make plastic barreled, you know, with a plastic nut. There's no metal option for that. You know, it's the Achilles heel of all equipment is the AC jacks. Even if you, you know, even if you're buying like a mixer, it might come in an all metal case, rugged, but the DC jack is—it's going to be little thing that's soldered on the board inside of and they drill a hole in the metal casings that you put the barrel through, and it's just wiggling on a thing that's just soldered on the pad. Mm. It's the Achilles heel of every piece of equipment that's made.
Yeah, but you can get metal panel mount ones though. You can get panel mount metal I think, yeah, they're mostly metal. I've used panel mount metal ones with the, you know, you screw on, you drill your hole in and you screw your thing on the back, and then you have to wire up to it, of course. So you can't mount it straight on your board. You've got to actually wire them in. Mm. I don't know if they're suitable or not.
Yeah. But,
yeah, tough business. That's just nuts.
Oh, I do not miss manufacturing at all. Yeah. I tried to really put a fine point on in that video, but still, even with everything I said, the comments are, look, why are you whining about it? Why don't you just say you don't want to do it and just shut up already?
Yeah, yeah. Well, no, I thought that was fascinating because I haven't heard you explain the whole process and the paint rooms and everything else. I thought that was brilliant. And then your next video after that was the Promised Land of Kits.
Yes.
And I've been in the kit business as well. Yes. And it's just, yeah, it's not, it's a mug's game, as we say here. Yeah. It's yeah.
Well, you have, who's the guy down in Australia who had the big kit business, the online catalog kit stuff down there?
Oh, that would be Colin Mitchell.
Mitchell, yes, that's it.
Colin Mitchell from Talking Electronics, yes. And he spent his whole life just selling like little $5 kits, you know?
Yep. See, when people think about Colin Mitchell's kits and they think that that's how you make your $1 million, but realize that he must have had a warehouse full of circuit boards that he never shipped.
Yes.
You know? And
he's still got them.
Yep. And you know, someone would order a Blinky kit, a 4511 Blinky kit, and he would go to a shelf, get one of the boards, go to another shelf, get a chip, get a socket, grab six LEDs, put it in a bag and everything, fill out the envelope, blah blah blah. People don't realize that you gotta have like a friggin' warehouse of parts to pick and place. To put together kits. It is not. It's like that classic tale of the Kickstarter where they get $1 million and they get 6 weeks that they got to deliver the product and they don't know freaking how to do it.
I know.
Because they don't realize that they have to have a 100,000 square foot facility just to house the parts that they're going to need to build their thing.
Yeah. It's nuts.
Yeah.
He, at one point, I think he had 4 or 5 staff working for him. You know, like really minimum wage kind of, you know, kids and stuff like that. Well, you know, working for him.
Child labor, bring back child labor for kids.
Yeah.
So get the kids out of the coal mines and picking kits.
Right. That's it.
It's safer. That's how we do it. That's how we do it.
That's how we can sell it. It's, it's safer than the coal mine. It's safer than, TikTok or something. I don't know. But yeah, and of course you mentioned that people just expect you to fix it under warranty, you know, even though it's
That's the thing. People don't even consider the Heath. It's the Heath kit paradox, which is people don't even consider the fact that you got to have customer service for all the kits that you sell that someone assembles and they don't work. Or they make a mistake and they just want it to work and they're going to send it back to you and you're going to have to fix it, you know. And if you're just selling a kit every month, maybe that's not a big deal. But if you're going to make a business of it and you're selling 10,000 kits a month,
absolutely.
You got to have a staff of people to fix kits, you know. You got to have like a room of people to fix kits and people just don't grasp that.
our magazine, one of our magazines here in Australia that used to sell we had the magazines, you would publish your article and then some of the kit suppliers would actually sell the kits, and they famously had a sorry dick it doesn't work service where you could, you know, look I built my kit, I followed your, you know, your detailed 50 page instructions and it still doesn't work, you can send it back in. And, they had to have a staff of people actually just repairing kits. So this was back in like the 80s, you know, early 80s kind of thing, late 70s, early 80s. I don't know. Is anyone still doing that? Is anyone at all like doing I know there are people who have kit businesses, but I'm not sure that they're at any scale that, you know, that they've got like a team of people just repairing them.
That's a good question.
I don't know. If anyone knows, leave it in the comments, but I don't think there's any left, really. So
hard to say. I don't know of any in the U. I mean, there's there's things like, you know, Adafruit.
Well, there'd be Sparkfun and Adafruit. Sparkfun. I don't think they have people repairing kits.
Yeah, I don't know what they do with returns. You know, it would seem to be. I mean, the real boondoggle with kits is the stuff that doesn't work. So I don't know if that would, if you would just, it would be cheaper just to have a policy where you just send them another kit.
rather than dealing
with the return.
Yep. I think that's how they deal with it, how the Spark Funds and the Adafruits would deal with it, surely.
Well, regardless of what your approach would be, you still have to deal with all the emails, and you still have to deal with the correspondence with the customers, and that's another staff altogether. I mean, if you're just one person, again, if you're having to move thousands of kits a month just to make a penny, you're dealing with thousands of emails a month from people who have all kinds of questions, all kinds of problems. Oh, I got the kit. I'm confused about this. Explain how this is going to go. And why does it do this? And why do you have to do that? And can't I do this? And can't I do that? And what if I took this wire and did that? And what, you know, if you did this jumper and everything, and I'm going to give you three paragraphs of why this kit could be improved if I just rewired it this way. I'm going to send you diagrams with drawings of how the traces should go and everything. And, oh, you know, if we shouldn't use this chip, you should use another chip. And it was much smaller profile, and then you can do it surface mount and blah blah blah.
Yep.
And multiply that times 100 people, and it's, you got to deal with that.
it's nuts. Yeah. And then you get like the nasty worded letters, you know, back in the day. Now it's emails, you know, but they would send the kit back because you'd publish your address, right? Even though you don't say, "Oh, send it back if it fails," they would just do it. Right. And then you get the nasty letters back. Your design is absolute trash. And here's, I've checked every single component and every single solder joint. And then you take 2 seconds, check the board, and you go, yeah, your 7805 is in backwards, you dick. You know, and it's like, yeah. And yeah, but no, they were positive. It was your design, your trash design. How dare you publish this? And, you know, it's just hilarious. And then they turn up at your doorstep with a kit wanting to fix it. So yeah, that was fun. So yeah, you know, they turn and they're kind of surprised. Like they turn up to your house and they think they turned up to a business, and they go, this can't be right. And then you go, yeah, come into my bedroom, you know, where my lab is, and I'll fix it for you. And then what the hell? Yep. Oh boy. Yeah, the kit business. Yeah, nah. It's bad enough with like the things I ship, like the actual products I ship. You know, occasionally they're faulty, and you know, and you have to deal with return issues, or you know, people have problem using them, for example. Like they just, you know, don't know how to use a multimeter. What can you do? I don't get it.
The only winning move is not to play.
Yes, exactly. Although I can't complain because a good half of my income, I think, comes from my packing and shipping business. So, you know, I'm not going to complain.
You've got quite a thing going on with the products.
Yeah, it's working fairly well. It's I'm doing it all myself again now. So, yeah, I'm getting into the flow of, like, doing it all myself. So I'm at the point where I don't know if I'll, like, hire another person, like, you know, like hire a person to do it, because the person who was doing it part-time for me, she can only do it a single like 1 hour a week or something now, and that's not really, you know, that isn't really enough. So yeah, I don't know whether or not to, you know, spin it off, like to actually put more investment into it and actually hire a dedicated space just for that, and hire a dedicated person. And you know, I like, if I was a serious businessman, I probably would, but you know, I'm just too lazy, I think. So, yep. I think both you and I are just doomed to the solo engineer kind of thing. You know, we're just a one man band. So, anyway, I wanted to talk about speaking of old school newspapers. Yeah. You started out, is it a regular segment now where you're looking through newspapers, like current newspaper articles and stuff, because you were talking about your wood, and I thought it was interesting.
I started doing it a couple weeks ago. I read the papers every day, so it just turned out that every now and then I'd set aside an article that I thought would be a good topic for discussion.
Yeah.
And as the days go on and weeks go on, they just pile up, and so it's like, well, this is stuff I could talk about, just stuff in the news. So something I've been doing.
That's in the real news, like as in the newspaper. So tell us about, you're trying to write a, trying to get a column in the Philadelphia Inquirer newspaper, trying to. 6 month journey. You've just released a video and and you haven't even gotten a single response and you physically turned up to their premises. And I think they went stalker alert.
Well, yeah, they've got very high security. It's weird because it wasn't that long ago, maybe 6 years ago, I actually, I went to the Inquirer's offices. I was up there for, it was some social meeting thing, like something related to something else, but they were meeting in the Inquirer's offices. So I'd been up there and it didn't seem, this is before the current state of affairs. It was before that massacre happened in that other paper. So obviously, I don't remember the security or anything. It was just, go right up and in. So obviously it's a sign of the times.
Things have changed. Yeah.
But yeah, there's just, yes, it's been difficult, but you suggested about, publishing, online. I didn't want to do that. I'm considering it because there are other things that I would want to do. It wouldn't be just, if I did the route that you're suggesting, it wouldn't just be a column. It would be, I basically publish my own like mini newspaper,
Right. Okay. It'd be that elaborate, would it?
Well, it would have
drawn into it so it much have, that you'd want to.
Well, okay. Puzzles and comics and.
That is newspaper. That is your own individual newsletter level, so to speak.
If I, the problem is going that route, it's not that I couldn't do that. It's just that, I've already got two full-time jobs.
Yeah, exactly.
So where am I going to scrounge the hours for the other two full-time jobs of running a newspaper?
Uh-huh. Yep. Well, you can start out with a column. I think because for those who don't know, I'm talking about Substack. I don't read stuff on there myself, but Substack is apparently the thing that all the hip kiddies are using to be all the hip independent journalists are using to publish their, articles and stuff now. And it's a subscription thing. It's not. I don't even think there's a free option.
It's all subscription.
All subscription based. But if if you want to get into a magazine, I guess my theory is that if you can show that you have people willing to pay to read your stuff, then you can go to them and say, "Hey, look, I've got 1,000 people willing to read my stuff." So
the thing is, if I had 1,000 people if I had 1,000 people subscribing to a column on that app. The last thing I would need is to be dealing with the bureaucracy of a newspaper because I'd be getting more than enough from the app.
But I got the impression that you were doing it because for the prestige. Oh, maybe prestige isn't the right word, but do you have?
There's definitely no prestige in it. I wanted to do it. It was strictly like a local thing, it's my paper, it's my city. And I wanted to do it as a form of like representation to represent Philly, basically take what I do here and reflect it somehow on the local level.
Local community level.
And I wanted the column to be an outlet for basically what Fran Lab represents. I've tried that before, like the Franklin Institute. I volunteer every year, and every year that they just ignore my application to volunteer. It's just a common thing, I might be a big deal on YouTube, but in Philly, I'm absolutely nobody, And here's the thing: the Inquirer. I mean, they have a total circulation of like 193,000, right?
Right.
So if even half of my subscribers were to read my column, if it were in the Inquirer, they would increase their subscription by 50%.
I know. I think it's an absolute no-brainer to take somebody with your audience and your, even though they don't know who you are, surely they can at least do the, 5 seconds of research to take to see the size of your audience and the views you get. And surely that would translate over into viewership for them. I don't get it.
I think it's something of the like of Well, you know, if we were going to have a science columnist, we want it to be Dr. Neil deGrasse Tyson.
And, right. Yes. Yeah, right?
And I'd be like, okay, well, is he knocking on your door about a job writing a column for you?
Exactly.
Oh no, we would want someone with a doctorate from Temple, you know, someone local, like an adjunct professor at Temple,
right,
maybe the former dean of Drexel University to write a column. Okay, well, are they calling you saying
you want to write a column
for you? I mean,
I would like
you it's a great job if you can
person.
Get it.
Yeah,
you know, it's like I'm Fran of Fran Lab. I'm living right here, like, you know, blocks away from your office.
Yeah,
you know, here's the thing, you know, when I came up with this idea last year that I decided that I wanted to write a column, I didn't even go into it thinking that I'd even be paid for it. You know,
I was going to ask that, would you do it if you weren't paid? Would you still do it just for the, you know, just for the fun of it? Or
I was going to do it just for a stipend. My goal at the time was just to basically to get published and just be able to have like a backlog of articles that were published. You know, because Fran Lab isn't going to be forever. I've been on the earth long enough to know the ephemeral and temporary nature of what we do.
Yep.
And
absolutely.
So there's definitely a finite end to this. And so I'm always looking for the next thing that I want to do. And for years, I've wanted the next thing to be writing. Mm-hmm. And because I'm an essayist, I really thought that a column would be the ideal format for me to output, you know, 850 to 1,000 words. You know, that's sort of my format. So, I was surprised that I didn't get a single reply.
Yeah, but that's just like a sorry, no, we don't, you know. One of the comments on the video is somebody suggested one of the options could be they have pre-decided their editorial policies at the highest level and do not consider them even worth discussing with anyone else. I can see that happening at a large newspaper like that. How many staff would they have at a large paper like that?
The Inquirer.
Do you know, is it like dozens or is it hundreds?
The Inquirer used to be a massively large paper.
Yes.
And they've been whittled down. I think they actually turned off, it was only a couple years ago, maybe it was last year, a couple years ago, they turned off their press plant and they're actually outsourcing the pressing of their actual paper to a company in, I think, Chester, a press company. They're also printing the Times. Basically all of the papers that you get regionally are all done at one press plant now.
Oh, interesting.
If you go on their website, you can scroll down, their staff, it's like 100 people. But if you actually read the paper every day, the actual people with the byline, it's like a dozen, you know, that they're actually like in, that actually have a byline and, you know, the picture and this is their column, maybe weekly. But like I said, I was willing to take the job, you know, for a stipend. Didn't have to be like some big salary thing, you know. But I probably burned the bridge when I complained about it, but who knows?
Yeah, probably. or the other thing somebody said here, you are sufficiently unique and original that they have no box to tick against you, and therefore your correspondence is endlessly circulating between people who all look and say, not me, I don't know, have a look at this. And everyone goes, I don't know. They just pass the parcel.
I doubt that they're even considering me. I think that probably none of my emails were read. None of my letters were read. I think it's just that simple.
Right. So what are your options now? Because clearly you want to do this. So is it to go to some other, try other publications? Does it matter who you get in with, you know, or does it, or would you start the online thing?
No, Philly's down to one paper. I mean, there used to be the city paper went dark years ago. The city paper was my favorite paper, and I would have loved to have written for the city paper. But that was a tremendously great publication. But they city paper got bought out by a competitor in town, that bought them out because they had gotten into financial trouble years before that, and they had like been rescued by like an investor, like a like an entrepreneur rescued the paper. They kept printing the paper, but then the competing paper came in and just went around the staff and just made the deal with the investor and just bought them outright and then shut them down the next day, bought them to kill them. And then, yes. So, and then the paper that bought them out ended up going out of business. So
Is there some other, like, can you go to the New York Times? Although everyone wants to get in the New York Times, right? Yeah. Or surely US has like, I don't know, 100 newspapers or something?
It's dwindling.
It's dwindling. 2,500. Surely somebody will back you up.
Well, they said something like 2,500 newspapers have closed in recent, like, the last 5 years.
Yeah. Wow.
But most newspapers that are still being published, there are owned by a handful of companies, mega conglomerates. No, I, it isn't that I want to write for a newspaper. I just wanted to write for my local newspaper.
Right. Okay. Right. So it's So it's pretty much done and dusted then. If you can't get into the Philadelphia Inquirer.
I mean, I'm considering your option of going
Substack, paid Substack thing. Yeah.
I'm considering.
I think you get at least a couple of hundred people. I'd subscribe.
Maybe.
In addition, you would get people in addition to Patreon. That's the thing too.
The biggest thing is the investment, the startup investment of a proposition like that. Because I figured if I did it that way, I would have to publish articles every week. And I'd have to do it for at least 3 years to know if it's a viable, doable thing. Just to build up the audience and everything. And while I'm building up the audience, very few people are actually reading the articles while I'm in the first year while I'm publishing them, yada, yada. I mean, I did consider the idea of a Kickstarter type thing.
Right, okay.
So that people, I don't know if how transferable that is, but the idea that people who bought into the Kickstarter, if I had a goal of a certain number of, a goal for the readership, and then people who buy into the Kickstarter, they get the membership for the, for the app or something like that. But I haven't worked it out. Mm. But yeah, it'd be more than if I had to publish that, it would be more than articles. It would be other things, puzzles and whatnot.
Got it. Almost, like a physical newsletter. You could almost print it. You could almost actually print your own and everyone gets a little booklet and then you're in the packing and shipping business again.
Yeah.
Congratulations.
Stuffing envelopes. That sounds great.
Oh, yeah. Oh, that's fun. Yep. Yep. I couldn't even do that right. I couldn't even do that right. I don't know if you remember, but when I was shipping my ruler, it wasn't Indiegogo. I was using a local, one to raise money. Everyone got one of these PCB rulers, and it was successful. I got thousands of people, so I had to ship thousands of these rulers. And I thought, how hard can it be? Stick them in an envelope and send them off. It turns out, it's incredibly difficult. And I wrote an entire article. I discovered that I had to figure out a way to make sure they didn't flap around in there. So each one had to be glued down to a cut sheet of cardboard for starters. And then I discovered that if they did come loose, then they would go out the sides. The flap, the envelope is got holes in the ends. And that was the same size as the ruler. So these rulers would just vanish in. If it went in the machine upside down, the ruler would just shoot out the end of the envelope. It's you're going to be kidding me. How hard can it be to ship some little PCB rulers? Yeah. It's a pain in the ass. I spent months handling that, just trying to ship out these bloody rulers. So yeah, no, don't do it. but yeah, certainly a Substack. I think we could do it. I think we could do it.
I'll consider it.
Excellent. One of your videos I liked recently was the Lumi Time, a digital clock with no electronics. And that was obvious. That was when you look at how they do it, it's with these rotatable contacts and these little, you know, tags, and they actually decode which segments turn off and on. And then they, and then you turn those wheels with a, you know, a gearboxy thing. It's great. I love like and so did everyone. That kind of went semi-viral and got a ton of views.
Yeah, in fact, someone put up a Lumitime clock, a slightly later one than this one. Went up on eBay today. It's already got like, I'd look just before I came on it. It had like 30 bids on it. It's already up to like $200 bucks. Yeah, so.
Right.
Yeah.
Yep, the Fran effect. Yep.
Well, this is the kickback effect of the YouTube channel, because when I get something cool and I do a video on it, if that video, I mean, most of my videos, 5,000 people maybe watch it. Very, very few people, but every now and then I do a video on an item and hundreds of thousands of people see it. And then that's it. I'm never going to buy another one again.
Yes.
Ten years ago, if a Nemo tube were to come on eBay, you probably could get it for $20. If it came up. Now you wouldn't be able to get one for $1,000 if it came on eBay. Burroughs tubes, you know, when I bought the first ones of these tubes, they were like, you know, $100 a tube, which was a lot of money back then. But ever since I made that video, now it's like $1,000 for three at a discount.
Ooh, wow. Yeah, I get the same complaints when I do like an eBay score. You know, I get a bit of test gear on eBay or something. Look at it. Buy this model. You know, it's a really obscure model, but it's really great. Bang per buck. And I got mine for $50 and now it's $500, you know.
Not anymore.
Sorry. And a lot of my patrons say, when you do an eBay score video, show us first, like several days before, so that then we can go on and find the cheap ones before everyone else gets it. You know, it's like, sorry, people. There's nothing we can do. I mean, if you want to see these videos, it's just a natural consequence of.
There's a display that I'm not going to say which one it is, but it's a display that I did a video on a few years ago. I've got like a dozen of them that I bought at the time for. I paid like $5-$10 a piece for them, you know, and I got like a dozen. A guy on eBay, he had a stock of like 18 or 20 of them, and so I contact the seller. I say, look, you know, I want to buy everything. You know, you have them up for one, you know, one off on
onesies.
The, I want to buy all, you know, the lot that you have, you know, and I said, I'm willing to pay this amount for everything that you have, which, you know, I was a fair offer. And his reply is LOL.
Right.
It's like, well, wait a second. I'm the only person who wants this display.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know, I'm the only person who want this display because they're like, LOL. It's like, it's almost like, oh yeah, I know you're the only person who wants the display, which is why I'm going to charge you $1 billion because I know only you would want it. And it's like, what kind of crazy effect is that when you get on eBay and the seller specifically is like, oh, I'm going to charge you this because I know that you're the one who's going to buy it and I know who you are.
Yep. What can you do? Oh, eBay's a fun place too. It's almost as fun as YouTube.
Well, it's gotten to the point where when I buy parts or films or, you know, if I'm trying to make a deal with a seller, they'll say, are you Fran? Are you the Fran?
Fran? Busted. I've had that as well.
I don't know. Yeah. Does that get me a good price or a bad price? It depends.
Yep. Yeah, because I often buy, because I've got my, I've got like 1,000 feedback on my personal account there, eBay, and it has no relationship to my channel, but people sort of get, you know, and I'll often, you know, and if I send them some sort of message, I'll sign it Dave. And then I've had, you know, replies back saying, you're not Dave from EEV Blog, are you? Yeah, busted. Okay. I haven't had them up the price on me. Like, I haven't had them, you know.
Yeah.
Usually they sort of, like, bend over backwards for me and pack it properly and, you know, do other things. So, yep.
Well, they would. They wouldn't want you to complain on the EEV Blog that
Exactly. That they're the best shit packing packer. Job. What is the worst packing job you've ever had? Like, you know, have you ever bought one of these like fragile tubes and it's just come like unpadded and it's shattered in the box or something?
I've had some good ones. I had a good one this week. I just yesterday I had to complain to a seller because I bought a film and I paid a good price for it.
A film reel, like a 16 millimeter reel.
Yeah. Yep. But it was on a plastic reel. And they just took the plastic reel, not in a case. Usually there's a hard shell case, you know, that the reel shipped in.
Right.
I've had most sellers, if they're not like archival film collectors, they'll put the reel in a case, they'll tape up the case, and they'll either just ship the case like in the hard case or they'll put the case in a bag. I usually insist that, okay, if it's in a case, put the case in a box. Don't just ship the case. Right. It depends on what I pay. But in this case, they took the bare reel without a case and they just stuck it in an envelope and mailed it. It looked like someone had sat on it and it was like cup shaped. It was like a cup shaped and the edges of the reel were extended over the film were like buckled over like nose, like crushed down. So it was crushed. It's like, I've had some good ones. I had one where I ordered some special incandescent bulbs, these long incandescent bulbs. It's for like a lawyer's lamp, you know, the old, you know.
Oh yeah, right. Like yes.
The long bulbs.
Right. Yep.
I had a special
lamp that holds
right. But I had a lamp that required one of those bulbs. I ordered from a seller and I bought three bulbs. They literally took the bulbs, put them in a paper envelope and shipped them. And they were pulverized. No. I said, you have to explain to me how you thought putting light bulbs in an envelope would work.
These are functioning adults, aren't they, that are doing this? You would think that a functioning adult would know about glass and like glass shatters. Like, I don't.
I make a lot of such assumptions, and I'm often wrong.
Know,
there are always some doozies. Now, here's an interesting thing. On the other side of the spectrum, I was going to show this in a video, but hang on.
Ooh,
I got the box thing around here.
There we go. We've got a good view of Fran Lab there. Can you laugh?
On the other side of the spectrum, this box, I ordered another clock that I was going to do a tear down of, and they put it in this box. It's actually a Philips box. This is the clock, but to fill in the gap, they stuffed it full of old VHS cassettes.
Oh!
just to fill in the box. I know.
I think they just maybe they're just recycling their collection, and they didn't want to throw them out. And they thought, people will use these, and they're freebies. They're actually using them as packing.
Yeah.
Well, that's incredible.
It's not like the lightweight. I mean, they weigh some.
No, I was going to say that just adds to the cost, the shipping cost.
It's not just empty boxes. That's actually VHS cassettes in there. But that was a first.
Is there anything good? What's on the tapes?
One is Little Big Man, and the other is Little Big Man.
I haven't heard of that one.
Oh, it's a fantastic film. It's one of my favorites. Dustin Hoffman. If you have never seen it, you should watch Little Big Man. It's my life is sort of like Little Big Man. The other one is a collection, The Best of Red Skelton.
I don't know what Red Skelton is either. Sorry.
Oh, classic American comic, clown comic, you know.
Oh, okay.
Kleb Kadiddle Hopper and yada yada. these were usually, Best of Red Skelton. It's actually like a full length cassette too. It's like a 60-minute cassette. Sometimes I used to work, I was assistant manager of a video store back in the early 90s, and sometimes these off-brand VHS cassettes, they would be recorded in like slow speed. So you might get like a, it might say like 60 minutes of material, and then you open up and the, you'd have like that, like a tiny little bit of tape. You record it on the 6 hour mode.
Like, yes. Like, it's like, yeah.
Right.
I remember at half the bandwidth.
Yeah, six hour mode, or sometimes four hour mode, which is the in between four hour mode.
Oh, but, boy. I always wondered how they made those things, because, you know, how can you make these things the millions and the tens of millions when you've got to, like, to physically record them, you've got to.
Well, they're recorded at high speed.
At high speed, okay, right. Yeah. And that would lower the quality, right?
Well, yeah, there's two ways to do it. I mean, if they're recorded actual, if those duplicating houses used to be massive, I mean, you would have.
Yeah, I know. I'd love to see one. Is there? I've never looked at like a photo of a duplicating house.
Well, I used to go to those places because back in the day, when I was a filmmaker back in the early 90s, I used to work with duplication houses, and even the small ones had hundreds. Like the VHS recorders were rack mount, right? So you would have like basically racks of maybe 20 recorders, like a wall of them, like a few hundred recorders, and they would literally have like cases of blanks, and they would just, you know, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, you know, they would load up a whole wall, right?
Wow.
All the machines would be synchronized to a master, right?
Yeah.
And a lot of these duplication places, like, they would master like on 1 inch or 3/4.
I was going to say the master would degrade over time as well, wouldn't it? So you'd get a progressive degradation.
Well, VHS is low resolution, doesn't have a lot of lines in it. But so you would use a high res, like a broadcast quality master, like a 1 inch or 3/4 master, and then they'd be synchronized with the other machines, and then they'd all start in sync.
Yep.
You'd have like one master running, record 200 or 300 in a shot.
Mm-hmm.
And then at the end of, if it's a 1 hour, 2 hour, when they're done, they all eject, and then they walk down the, you know, with a cart, with a big box,
pull them all out. Label.
Right. They pull them all and refill them and run another 300.
Wow. But yeah,
those duplication houses, a lot of them would run 24 hours, you know.
Wow. You wouldn't have any old like film footage of that, would you? Did you ever shoot?
No.
No, footage inside one of those places? No. I'm going to have to Google it now.
I probably did. I wouldn't have the tape anymore because I lost all my originals back from the early 90s. I lost probably mid-aughts. I don't have them anymore. But at the time I would have had like footage of, especially like when I transferred a couple of things, because I used to have like stuff duplicated back in the old days. Used to, if you made short videos, they called them films, but they were videos.
Right.
You would sell them through publications. Like, there was a magazine called Film Threat that a lot of indie filmmakers and video makers used, and you put an ad in Film Threat for your cassette. And, you know, get mail orders, and then you'd ship out, you know. So so I would duplicate my film projects and, you know, have like a stock. People send in orders. And it'd be like, you know, $10. So you get a $10 bill in an envelope and, you know, cash. And then you put it and, you know, be like a couple weeks. But, yeah, that's, you know.
Wow.
Here's an interesting thing. I know we're hitting the hour, but I want to talk about this with you, because I had it in my queue, one of the questions I wanted to ask, which, rather than just asking it rhetorically, if the internet had never been invented, what would you be doing right now?
Ooh, I would still, I've got to say, because I'm still doing the YouTube thing after 12 years, I got to say, I'd still be doing the same thing I was doing pre-YouTube, which would be writing magazine articles. I'd be selling kits. I'd still be maybe not kits. I'd be selling finished products. Maybe I'd get sick of the kits or something, or kits would naturally die out as they have. I don't know. I'd probably be like a mini Adafruity. Well, no, because they're all internet. Their whole stick is that everything's on the internet, right? All the information's on the internet. So
you'd have to make a, you'd have to be publishing a catalog.
I almost, before this blog, I thought about publishing my own electronics magazine. I almost did it. Mm. I started writing some articles and stuff for my own electronics. So maybe I would have got into the magazine publishing business. Mm. Maybe. Mm-hmm. I don't know, but I'd still be at least writing articles. I'd be selling kits. I'd have my own side hustle business, you know, selling kits and stuff. And if there was no internet, yeah, I'd be advertising my stuff or publishing my articles. Yeah, I'd still be doing that.
Yeah, probably the same. I think I think I'd still be, I'd probably have a cable access show and I'd probably be selling my goofy film productions through the magazines and still, still, well, if they would have never invented the internet, then I'm assuming we'd still be doing linear editing on tape. So
yes,
I'd probably still be doing that. Because that's the other thing without the internet, we wouldn't have had, you know, digital non-linear editing wouldn't have come about. It wouldn't have been very popular. So
I would never have got into video because I was never into film or video. Like I was never into photography or video or anything like that. We were just too poor to have a video camera. I probably would never, maybe I would have, I don't know. I can't see myself getting into the video, you know, I can't say without seeing other people do it. The reason I did the YouTube thing is because I saw other people doing YouTube and I thought, oh, maybe I could do like an engineering one, you know? So there wouldn't have been any motivation there to start up a video thing, I don't think.
I'm going to take, take a leap and suggest that I think that if the internet had not been invented, that rather than your huge EEV blog lab, you would have a humongous train setup, like a big train platform.
Probably.
Because if the internet if the internet hadn't been invented, then trains would still be a big thing. Like train stores would still be a big thing.
Yep.
Because all the brick and mortar stores, the Radio Shacks, the hobby stores, the big train stores, the big model stores, all those places would still be alive.
Oh, yes. Without the internet. They would.
And all the culture that was around them. The slot racing places that, you know, used to have, like, people would buy up like a storefront and build a huge the slot racing tracks in there.
Yes. I've got my videos of my local hobby shop shutting down and I scored their big train set from there and stuff like that. And yeah, that was sad. But then again, the other question is, what would happen if there was the internet but no e-commerce? What if nobody had you invented the internet so you share information but you couldn't buy anything online? Nobody invented the secure hashy, you know, thing it's called that e-commerce.
Like if credit cards hadn't been invented, but the internet had. Like with the idea of if it was a cash economy.
You still have to manually process the credit card with the the swiper type, the slider thing.
It's hard. That's a hard leap to make only because in my own mind, money is such an easy construct in any form. The internet not being so easy a construct to fathom. I mean, it's very easy. It's very easy to imagine the internet never happening, you know, because the only reason it did happen was just because that there was an unusual government intervention during the Clinton administration. They actually like did something that governments aren't supposed to do. And they actually like put a lot of money into the idea of building a World Wide Web. It could have very easily just stayed a university military thing.
It could have. Yeah. Mm. We'd still be dialing up bulletin boards and, you know,
Well, that wasn't so bad.
No, I had great fun, you know. Oh, damn, I'm going to have to call back. It's busy. This BBS sucks. It's only got 8 lines or whatever, you know. You can't. I might have been running my own BBS. Maybe. I might have been,
doing that. It goes back the whole halt and catch fire sort of that brief moment of time, you know.
Yep. That's terrific.
slightly fictionalized.
I
don't really remember it being that exciting.
No, it's not. It's not that exciting. No, it's incredibly boring. those were the days.
But what I really regret about, you and I, we make our living and build our lives around this thing.
Yes. But, yeah, we have.
But the loss of the culture that culture that used to exist of, you know, like I said, those retail stores, like the Heathkit stores and the Radio Shacks and everything, where you would go to talk about stuff with other human beings that were right there and show things off that you built that's never coming back.
No,
we're it's never not. Getting it I back.
I can remember being in one of the shops in the city here, and yeah, and they sold kits and everything, and one of them happened to be my kit, you know, and you know, somebody there, you know, I was just in there hanging around, you know, and then somebody said, "Oh, and check out this oscilloscope kit. I love this." And I went, "Yeah, it's mine." And then we just started yapping on for, you know, ever about the design of the, you know, thing and the software and everything else. And yep. Those were the days. It was very local. It was more local. Like, as I said before, if the e-commerce thing hadn't have happened, the e-commerce enabled global trade and commerce. Whereas if you still had to accept like the credit card, you know, swipey dipe, did that work internationally? I don't think I ever bought something internationally on credit card before the internet.
Yeah, the international commerce really, I think that's very strangely recent because it wasn't until those intermediary companies like PayPal and stuff came in to actually transfer currency. Mm. It really was, because
it was
PayPal. Was PayPal the first? They were one of the first.
It was one of the first. I don't think it was, one that became popular.
Yeah, but until those intermediate companies, those exchange rate companies that would exchange like pounds for dollars or marks, or, you know, be able to do it, you know, commerce from one currency to another and, you know, and make that happen. Yeah, it was very unusual to buy something with a country that had a different currency. I never bought anything internationally back in those days. I don't really know how it was done. I imagine it would have been just you put cash in an envelope and hope that they wouldn't just take it.
Yep.
There was a lot of trust in those days.
Trust. The amount of cash I got in the mail is just phenomenal. You know, it's just nuts. Yeah. Physical cash just shipped to my home address.
That's the other thing. People today don't realize that back in like 20 years ago, buying anything, you were writing off 100% of what you were putting in the mail that you might not ever see.
You might not see it again. Yep. You know? Totally. Yep. But and people were honest. I don't remember ever getting ripped off. I don't think so. That's interesting. And I can remember I think it might have been pre-PayPal. I was selling kits on my website. And it was just, I wanted to accept, credit cards. And of course it wasn't easy. Like, so I, you know, had to call up my local bank, and then a bank representative came out. It was at my company at the time. So we went in the conference room and I sort of pretended to be all professional and everything. And, and here we are trying to negotiate, you know, basis points rates for the credit card commission and all this sort of stuff and all the red tape that you had to go through to set up to accept credit cards. And then, PayPal came along and it just changed everything. You know, you put your credit card in once and they did. It wasn't just the currency transfer. It was the fact that you could put your credit card in to them and then it'd pay through that, you know, so you could use them as an intermediary. Now we have, Stripe and other third party players like that. But back then you had to deal with the bank. The bank had to give you a merchant facility, it was called, and then they would physically give you a swiping machine as well, you know, and it was a real huge deal.
Wasn't PayPal originally, it came out of eBay, correct? What wasn't eBay and PayPal?
They were tied together. eBay purchased PayPal. They purchased them. They originally integrated, and then they had to split. And then they had to split them once they sold off PayPal. Yeah, once, and then that changed everything. You know, once you didn't have to get a merchant facility at a bank to accept credit cards as a business. You know, and it was changed everything. So yeah, I think it'd still be local. I think if there was no e-commerce, everything would still be fair. Although people would find ways around that, I guess. Once you've got the internet opened, international flow of information, I guess naturally the credit stuff and the money stuff and the credit stuff would naturally happen. But I don't know. That's interesting. Yeah, if nobody ever invented, because for a long time that was a thing. There was a lot of pundits saying you would never be able to do online shopping because nobody had cracked. I can't remember the guy's name, but he came along and published this paper, and he actually cracked. Is it the two? There's a name of the algorithm that allows it. Is it the one-time pad? I'm not sure, but anyway, there's a secure. You know, he actually cracked. The public private key thing. So before public and private keys were invented, you could not do online commerce. You just couldn't do it. There's no way to do it securely. So nobody did it. And once that technology was cracked, bingo, it exploded. So if that didn't happen, that's another interesting historical path that we could have taken.
Yeah.
Because the internet was always going to happen. Well, it always was there, right? In terms of dial-up BBSs, you could share. It was just hard, you know.
It's sort of been there since the tendrils of it began in the '60s, right? With the
of course.
So it's an interesting alternate reality. I'm waiting for them to start the new season of For All Mankind, and
right. And,
I'll wait to see what happens with my shows that have been on hiatus for forever.
Awesome. Well, I think our amp hour is up, Fran. Thank you for stepping in for Chris.
All right. At
last minute, literally almost last minute.
Yeah. I'm glad we could synchronize because your the day and my day are very
what is
different.
It, 8:30 p.m. or something there?
After 8. So,
It is 10:30 a.m. ahead in the future here. So it's now Friday the 15th.
You're talking to me from tomorrow.
Yes.
It is tomorrow where you are.
Another marvelous advancement of technology.
Well, I'm just glad we could get all the technical glitches.
Yeah,
we
did.
Out.
Yeah. It still can't get it sorted. Like, you know, it's just, all this marvelous tech we've got, and it still sucks ass. Like, you know, it's still incredibly difficult just to talk to somebody on the other side of the planet and get it all working. Like, it's not seamless. It's like, always have issues. It's just everyone we sort of chat with. Yep, it doesn't support this browser extension or this browser or this thing, or, you know, there's a Windows conflict or there's, you know, it's just,
Well, I'm glad we pulled it together.
I don't know why we're in this business. Why are we in this business? I don't know.
Still haven't gotten used to the time delay, but I'm glad we could pull it together.
Cool. Awesome. Thanks, Fran. Good to catch up again, and we'll do another one soon.
All right.
Catch you next time.
Bye.